You.
Hey.
It's a pleasure to be in Toronto. I thank the organizer. I even saw the city from the airplane because then the conference was made so interesting that I didn't have any other chance to go around. It was well. I mean, I will start by giving a kind of a summary about the multi-faced role of conformal invariance in quantum field theory on my first slide, and then I will concentrate on just one of the many aspects. So, well, I mean, when you speak about quantum field theory, you always start with the classical one, and the invariance of the classical Maxwell equations was one of the first discoveries in the early 20th century, Cunningham. And now, when you go to quantum field theory, you find that conformal and even scale invariance are one among those which don't automatically go to the quantum case because of renormalization precisely. But that actually makes things more interesting. You connect with critical theory and with non-perturbative aspects. So then one has had within conformal field theory models and the concepts of conformal invariance discovered new concepts of quantum field theory which are now among the commonly used ones. We have anomalous dimensions, the notion of braid group statistics from two-dimensional model, computable Dress propagators and vector expansions. One thing I would like to mention, which relates to yesterday's talk of Stefan Holland, is that we have an approach to quantum field theory in curved space-time, because in fact, from the point of view of conformal invariance, one should regard different spaces which are connected by a conformal factor that is in the same class of, in particular, all conformally flat space-times as just different coordinatization of the same physics. And I think this has not been fully achieved yet in the present formalism. So there are also problems which are suggested. Now, furthermore, conformal compactification of Minkowski space, which is necessary to make sense of finite conformal transformations without singularities, gives a natural symmetric infrared cutoff, because it leads to three-dimensional space in the conformal compactification is just a sphere. The conformal compactification of Minkowski space is S3 times S1 over Z2. Now, here are the references on which my talk will be based, and they split into very different in times set. So one is over 30 years ago, a joint work with Gerhard Mack, and which had some follow-up, and that is uses the common, well, widely used actually until today, notion of infinitesimal special conformal transformation, invariance under, say, global Poincaré transformations and dilations, but only with respect to infinitesimal conformal transformations, and that leads to a specific type of model building with fractional anomalous dimensions. And there is a recent development which started in the year 2000, so we have, I've cited here some four of our papers. It's work with Nikolov and Stanev in Sofia and Rome now, and with Karl-Henning Kreren in Göttingen. And that uses a notion of global conformal invariance. And although global conformal invariance is a special case of infinitesimal, it's a stronger requirement, it leads actually to a different set, in effect, to a complementary way of looking at the main problem, which is addressed, the problem of trying to construct a model of satisfying in four-dimensional quantum field theory model satisfying all axioms. And I can say, as one of the previous speakers, that it's still too early to have the final result on this, but I think it's good to know some intermediate steps as well. So I will start with telling you the story of how anomalous dimensions were discovered. If you, for those who don't haven't followed it, one can start with the classic work of Bohr and Rosenfeld in 1933, where on the basis of analysis of measurement in quantum electrodynamics, they said that one needs space-time averaging to have observable quantities. And this was formalized 20 years later in axiomatic quantum field theory, in the work of Haack, Weitmann, and Golubov in Russia, who pointed out that there is no well-defined notion of an interacting sharp time field. So canonical commutation relations is something only suitable for free fields in four-dimensional space-time. And this was something ignored by mainstream theorists until it was discovered in models as a positive statement, not as a restriction to what you can use. And it was, in fact, discovered twice. First, in the framework of the Ising model, that was in, well, Onsager already had it implicitly in 1944, and it was made explicit in the quantum field theory framework by one of our participants here, Leo Kadanov, in 1969. And secondly, it was rediscovered in the Turing model. The model was formulated by Turing in 1958, and it was already Ken Johnson in 1961 who had a sentence in his paper that one sees that one should follow the axiomatic, not the canonical approach, to have the conceptual framework for understanding the tuning model, but this was not, I mean, Ken Johnson was a student of Schwinger, and Feynman was more popular, so for some time people didn't read what he said. Then came Kent Wilson, and he was some mainstream theorist going, I mean, ahead to his Nobel Prize. And he had it in the beginning wrong. The story is told by Werner Naum in a 2000 review lecture in India. He thought that the logs persist. He found logs in second approximation, so one should have always logs in quantum field theory. Johnson told him that, see, there is a model here when the logs, powers of logs, happen to sum up into a power, which becomes anomalous dimension. And then Wilson did write a paper which was read in 1970, and after all, the anomalous dimension became something physicists started appreciating and applying to higher dimension as well. And as far as the Turing model goes, I'm reminding you, it's a four fermion interaction which was solved when people wrote it in terms of currents, and you see the anomalous dimension in the two-point function, for instance, and typically the function becomes more singular at light-like separation because you add g squared to the canonical value 1 of the power of x squared, and this we'll see is in fact related to Whiteman positivity. And of course, if you expand in powers of g, you'll find all types of log x squared to any power, the exponential power development. Now, then, when you try to make a multidimensional generalization of it, you have to be in, first of all, to talk about a renormalization group fixed point. Therefore, you have a Gell-Mann-Low limit theory, a zero of the Kalman-Simancic beta function. This is the only chance to recover scale invariance, and then if your stress energy tensor is traceless at the critical point, you also have conformal invariance. In fact, usually the two go together. And then one can try to approach the theory using this higher symmetry, which gives the Drest propagator, that's almost trivial, already scale invariance, given the dimensions of the field, tells you that the two-point function is proportional to x12 squared to the power minus d, where d is the full dimension. I mean, what is the sum of canonical and what's called anomalous dimension. But more than that, three-point functions are also recovered up to a normalization constant from conformal invariance. But here, I just want to remind you that Whiteman or Hilbert space positivity tells you that the anomalous dimension has to be positive. That is, that the full dimension of a field should be larger or equal to the canonical one. And I have illustrated this on the example of a scalar field. The statement, the proof is really easy, so I think it's only pedagogical to present easy proofs. It is you make Whiteman positivity for two-point function means positivity of the Fourier transform, that the Fourier transform should be a measure. Now, in this case of dilation invariant function, you compute the Fourier transform. I'm using space-like metric, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And then you see that the Fourier integral gives indeed a measure. Its absolute value of phi squared times the characteristic function of the forward cone. And the power is d minus 2. And this gives something which is convergent when d is infrared convergent at small p square when d is bigger than 1. You can capture also the canonical point d equal 1 because of this gamma function which has a pole at d equal 1 and that tends to a delta function in this case which is still a positive measure. So you see that just by positivity means that you don't have to put an infrared subtraction to make the thing convergent in the lower limit, and it requires dimensions to be bigger than canonical. And that's an important thing. So we have exactly the same for spinor fields. Then the canonical value is 3/2, and d prime Whiteman positivity implies that it should be larger than 3/2. Now, it was discovered by Polyakov in 1970, ancient times, that you can write the three-point function when you have conformal invariance. So this is the Dress three-point function. So if you approach the problem in perturbation theory, you have to sum up infinite number of diagrams. And for the scalar case, it's just written in terms of a kind of an infraparticle diagram where the dimensions on these fictitious internal lines are so chosen that you have conservation of dimension in each vertex. D1 is equal delta 2 plus delta 3, etc. You see the point. Of course, when you have spinor or tensor or vector fields, you have to take care of the spin structure, but I mean, these are technicalities. This has also been done, and the result, say, for a Yukawa interaction that was, you see, in the ages before QCD, people still were interested in Yukawa theory and phi to the fourth. But this was not the only reason. In the 1970s already, gauge theory were also in vogue, but conformal invariance doesn't apply directly to those because it applies to, so to speak, to observable fields. And to gauge-dependent fields don't have to be, even in a conformal invariant theory, don't have to be, in fact, cannot possibly be. It leads to contradiction. And that's a reason that one can go further in an old-fashioned Yukawa type or phi to the fourth theory. So what you have in a Yukawa theory, you have dressed propagators and rest vertex function, and moreover, and so you can further consider skeleton diagram expansion, something people from time to time remember that can be done if you use the full propagator and the full vertex function. But in the standard formalism, this is a kind of wishful thinking because you don't really have this infinite sum. Here, in such a model, limit theory, you do have, and you just plug known power expressions. So here is the simplest skeleton diagram with these vertex functions and propagators, which I wrote. Now, we pointed out that propagators become more singular, not less singular, at short distances. But in a way, vertex functions, on the contrary, they, you see, when we speak here about vertex functions, it is amputated three-point functions, which you have taken off the propagators because that's what correctly gives you the skeleton graph expansion. And then those, the amputation that is taking having no external lines in the three-point function, the passage from the upper diagram, when you do have external lines, to this one, goes through a transformation in which the dimensions are replaced by what is called the shadow dimension, 4 minus d. This notion was introduced by an Italian group, Ferrara, Gatto, Grillo, Parisi, in 72. And it turns that the vertex functions, this vertex function actually provide a cutoff. And if you look carefully into the momentum space picture, as one usually does in power counting to apply Weinberg-type theorem, you find that the Feynman integrals, the generalized Feynman integrals you encounter, are convergent. Ordinary Riemann integrals, simple integrals, provided the dimensions are in such an interval, which means the dimension of the scalar or pseudo-scalar field is between 1 and 3. So it means that both the dimension and the shadow dimension exceed the canonical value. This is the reason. And the same for the spinor dimension. D prime is between 3/2 and 5/2. And but you have to exclude for the scalar field the integer point d equals 2. This doesn't work for skeleton, then get divergent at integer point. And that's very important because this will have an alternative way which works precisely at integer points in the second half when we use this global conformal invariance. So for this range of dimensions, it was proven carefully that you have no divergences, either infrared or ultraviolet for non-exceptional momenta in any finite diagram. Of course, the problem of the convergence or divergence of the whole series is wide open as you expect. Now, you see that given conformal invariance, we don't need a Lagrangian to write down three-point functions and propagators. They follow from conformal invariance. But does something remain from the equations we are accustomed. Now, it is actually known that the Schwinger-Dyson equations is something which is not only valid in Lagrangian field theory, in perturbative theory. Simansky had analyzed it in renormalized equations. And now I have written symbolically the Schwinger-Dyson equations. Now, it gives to physicists, it's quite concrete thing. To mathematicians, I won't try to explain in all details. I will only say that this first picture, the simple vertex without a bubble here, is a constant. We'll see the constant afterwards. So when, and this constant is either it contains renormalization parameters, so it's ill-defined constant actually when you try to make sense of this. And one of the tricks which Simansky used in his it's again something you have a hard time to find, not only it's preceding the era of the archive, but it is published in some obscure lecture notes only in 65, but it's a nice paper nevertheless. So he differentiates one, so he obtains renormalized integral differential equations, and then the first term just disappears. And this is very handy in our case, because we can integrate these Simansky equations and demand, instead of a boundary condition for this, or initial condition for this term, demand scale invariance of the whole equation. And then you see that once you have anomalous dimension, the scale dimensions of this funny term would have been different than the two other terms. So it should just vanish. There is another way for those who believe in this renormalization procedures with the Z parameters, which are infinite or zero, which leads to the same result. If you write this in standard law theory, you have this renormalization for the pseudo-scalar field and the spinor field, and they have both to be zero just because you need this infinite weight function renormalization to get positive anomalous dimensions. So it's consistent. Various way of deriving lead to the same result. You have, instead of the standard inhomogeneous equation, you have a homogeneous integral equation for the three-point function, where this bubble here with a line is what is called the Bethe-Salpeter kernel. So you take sum of two-particle irreducible diagrams. So this was first introduced by Migdal, who called it a bootstrap equation. It's like a bootstrap. So, and you have a similar equation for, well, not exactly similar. You have also counterpart suitable for our purposes of the Schwinger-Dyson equation for the propagator, for the two-point function. Here you deal with the discontinuity of the two-point function, and there is such a form which the line, intersecting line, means that you replace these propagators by the mass shell delta functions, like Kutkowski rules, they were told in the sign. And so you have as many equations as you have dimensionless parameters. So you have the coupling constant in two dimensions, and you have three equations, one for the vertex function, one for the bosonic scalar propagator, and one for the fermionic two-point function, which is similar, and I didn't care to write it. So, in principle, you will end up with a theory with no free dimensionless parameters in it. Well, I mean, the question is still open, I think, with this more than three decades afterwards, the possibility is there, but you have to do to have more ideas to actually implement, either sum up the skeleton expansion and actually solve the resulting equations. One of the methods which was developed at the time, and which was again non-perturbative, was to take exactly, there are two properties which you have to meet for higher point correlation functions. One is positivity, or called unitarity, and the other is locality, or crossing symmetry. And now, this unitarity condition can be taken explicitly into account, non-perturbatively, by using conformal partial wave expansion. Now, physicists are accustomed, especially phenomenologically minded ones who consider S-metric theory, that if you make partial wave expansion, you make unitarity of S-metrics manifest. You have just a phase unitarity, you expand in eigenvalues of the of a unitary operator. It turns out that you have an off-shell generalization of this, which amounts to expand in representations of the in the middle of the conformal group, and that gives you unitarity, it agrees with the equations and gives a unitary expansion, but on a price. You select the first two arguments and the certain four. You have symmetry with respect to x1, x2, that's okay, but if you want to see the crossing symmetry between x2 and x3, you have to have duality relation, as it came to be called, between two such expansions, and this has only been solved in two-dimensional models, not in the more realistic four-dimensional ones. So this is how things came in the 70s, and in the early 80s, people started recognizing that if you are more modest, and before dealing with the theory of functions of several complex variables, you learn your undergraduate course on analytic functions of one complex variable. So they started constructing two-dimensional conformal models, and that taught us something. First, told us that you have it's good to divide the fields into observables which form a chiral algebra and have much wider invariance properties than the primary fields which interpolate, intertwine between different representations of the chiral algebras. And it turned out that in spite of general beliefs and folklore that two dimension is completely different, you cannot extend it, it turned out that if you look at it in a proper way, all these notions have a counterpart which is valid for any number of space-time dimensions. So here on this transparency, I first repeat, this is a reference of lecture notes in physics about our attempt to use this conformal partial wave expansion, and I repeat here the difficulties which we had at the time in either summing the skeleton expansion or combining unitarity and locality. And now taking experience of two-dimensional conformal field theory, the important notion is a stronger which was devised by Nikolov and myself. It's so simple that I really am surprised that nobody in the past, including ourselves with Erhard Mach, had thought of it. That if you take seriously finite conformal transformations in Minkowski space, here Minkowski and Euclidean are very different, and combine it with locality, it has extremely strong implications. The point is that Weitmann formulation of locality, we heard about it yesterday, it tells you that fields should commute at space-like separation. But any pair of space-like separated points can be transformed by a finite special conformal transformation into a pair of time-like separated points, not isotropic. Isotropic points, that is, with light-like separation, form a separate orbit of the conformal group action. So then, from Weitmann's locality, you deduce the Huygens principle that commutator has support only in the light cone, and that's extremely strong form of locality. Of course, when I speak about the consequences and axioms, people immediately ask the question, but I mean, it's impossible. You saw that in the Turing model, the charge field build it up arbitrary anomalous dimension. Now, Turing model is exceptional in that the beta function believed to be identically vanishing. So you have a perturbative approach to the conformal theories. But also in the Turing model too, the current keeps having canonical dimension because that is related to the conservation law. But the current is a composite field. So the axioms which we accept, and first of all, this strong global conformal invariance axioms, should physicists should see it applying to such observables which are usually thought as composite fields, like the stress energy tensor, current, conserved currents when you have abelian theory. Now, the nice thing with the Huygens principle is that it makes allows to formulate the locality condition in a really in an algebraic form. This is something which already was explored in the two-dimensional framework, and I think I have some time, so I can remind you that in the case of two dimension, the conformal field theory led to a new mathematical concept, the concept of vertex algebras, as it was called. I think it's a bit of this misnomer, but you cannot change it because, well, that's how mathematicians understood at the time the concept of a vertex operators, which physicists were using. They took a easy special case and called it vertex algebra. It started with Borchert, the Fields Medal winning work of 86. There are now many developments. I have cited few textbooks, work of Zhu is particularly is little known and but important because it relates modular properties and elliptic correlation functions for this vertex algebra theory. And it was Victor Katz who pointed out that now the important thing in the vertex algebra, which is relevant for what I'm saying, is that local commutativity. Pardon? No, but I'm willing to point this equation, which is. This is a purely algebraic form of locality. You define in this vertex algebra approach fields as formal power series in a complex variable Z, and then you say that for a sufficiently high power of Z minus W multiplying the commutator, you get identically zero. This becomes an algebraic identity. Now, here there are a few steps. First, Z is compactified light cone, so this is something really specific for the two-dimensional theory that the light cone splits into a product of light rays, and you can compactify each. And then you have such a simple algebraic relation. This played a role of understanding really the interesting infinite dimensional Lie algebras. That is something which Victor Katz had stressed in his Wigner Medal acceptance speech, that it is just algebraic locality, which I mean eventually was borrowed from the physicist ideas, that for him made sense of the interesting infinite dimensional Lie algebras, which were discovered in a kind of formal way. You looked at Cartan classification and you relaxed one of the assumptions that the determinant of the Cartan matrix is positive. You took Cartan matrix, which has a zero determinant, and got the affine algebras. But it turned out that you could really understand the things and combine precisely the interesting from various points of view infinite dimensional Lie algebras by putting as the important central axioms this algebraic formulation of locality. So that would then include the Virasoro algebra, called so because it was discovered by Gelfand and Fuchs 3 years before Virasoro's paper, W algebras, Borchert algebra related to the monster. And now, these things happen to apply also to higher dimensional theories if you use global conformal invariance. Now, one thing you need is the analog of this Z variables. When you have the circle and the disk for analyticity, the circle for the physical boundary. And it turns that there is a realization of compactified Minkowski space, which I've described long ago, which is a complex realization such that indeed the analyticity domain of a field applied to the vacuum, which follows from energy positivity, the so-called forward tube domain, in this image, here is the transformation with a complex, it's a complex conformal transformation such that for vectors in the tube you get a precompact domain. So the image of the tube in this domain is all connected, contained in the unit ball in four dimension. It is one of those Cartan type domains. And then you can introduce the concept of vertex, higher dimensional vertex operator that was done in a careful mathematical, from the mathematical point of view, paper by my PhD student Nikolov. So again, you have expansion in terms of a formal power series, but you cannot have a power series in a single variable. So you take positive and negative power of Z square, where Z square is this four-dimensional complex vector with Euclidean signature. You know that the group, conformal group in Minkowski space is SO42, and in this Euclidean, in this realization, it is this SO4 part which it's the image of the our standard coordinates, and you, in order to make, pardon?
The underlying
vector, yes, that's three vector. So Z square is the three vector square. This is Z1 square plus Z2 square plus Z3 square, and this is Z4. It's, I think, customary in physics notation. And this phi and m, to make this unique, the separation of Z square to some power, you impose, you ask that phi and m are harmonic polynomials, and they are homogeneous harmonic polynomials. So then there is a simple lemma which tells you that this is unique. And again, therefore, you have a formal power series of this type. I mean, only Z square can appear in negative powers. The component of Z appear in this homogeneous harmonic polynomials. And then we have all the ingredients of the one-dimensional formulation, complex variable formulation of vertex algebra, including the state field correspondence, which says that for any finite energy states, that now the energy counts the degree of homogeneity of our vectors, overall homogeneity, and for vectors you have the, that they annihilate the vacuum for n smaller than zero, so these terms with negative n do not contribute in the state. When a single field is applied to the vacuum, you have here just a convergent Taylor expansion in this tube domain which was written, And to any, we have also some complex translation generators, which commuting with phi gives the derivative in z, and here they are defined. And then you end up with a correspondence between vectors in a pre-Hilbert space. It's not closed under the Hilbert norm, and local fields, vertex operators, which acting on the vacuum give this very vector times the translation operator. Thank you. Okay. So, now here is, I was speaking about energy positivity. The conformal Hamiltonian is just this. It appears, looks superficially as a translation, as a dilation in the z variable picture, but it is actually moving the phase, which is a conformal time variable. And here is what I said. We had a state space which is graded. In general, if we have fermions, it is 1/2 z graded or 1/2 n graded state space. Now, I was promising you to open a new chapter in model building. And this comes about because one proves that this strong locality condition, which we were able to formulate in the case of higher dimension by using the formal power series I wrote, and instead of having complex variables, we have the square of z minus w squared to the power n. So this tells you that not only the support of the commutator is on the light cone, but also that it's a distribution of finite order, that its singularities don't exceed a given number n. And in fact, this n is just given the minimal value of n is given by the representation of the conformal group, the dimension and the Lorentz labels. J1 and J2 are half integers, non-negative, which speak of it. Now, it's a theorem that the strong locality together with energy positivity implies rationality of correlation functions. And when you have rational functions, you can already determine not only 2- and 3-point functions, but any correlation functions within finite number of parameters. And here is the example of a 4-point function. In general, it would, if we didn't have rationality, it would be an undetermined, essentially arbitrary function of 2 conformally invariant cross ratios. Now, it appears that it is a polynomial in these cross ratios, and because of Whiteman positivity, which says roughly that the singularity of truncated functions should be strictly smaller than the singularity of 2-point function at the pole, we have polynomial of a fixed degree given the representation. So we impose the crossing symmetry condition, and we still have only a small number of parameters. It's an integer part of d square over 3 parameter for a scalar field when d is the dimension of the field. So this for d equals 2, 3, 4 is 2d minus 3. essentially it is one parameter for d equal 2, three parameters for d equal 3, and five parameters for d equal 4. So it is completely manageable expressions that we are getting. And these satisfy, again, all the axioms except for Weismann positivity. And in order to verify Weismann positivity, we use this conformal partial wave expansion, which I wrote about, talked about in the beginning. Now, here I have written some explicit expressions for the correlation functions of scalar fields to see that not only there exists, no, but that they are quite manageable, the expressions which one can write. And it turns out that using conformal partial wave expansion, this was something which we did together with Rerin, one can fully analyze the analyticity, the positivity of a four-point function, obtaining some inequalities for the five parameters which were appearing there. Now, I don't think I have the time, and it is meaningful to flash to you formulas which appear in this. I would just make some concluding remark. As I said in the beginning, we are still not of a complete four-dimensional conformal model. We have put our faith in a model of a field of dimension 4 in four space-time dimension, which has the property of a Lagrangian or action density, because this, we know from model building, is the first scalar field which has a chance to be gauge invariant and therefore and to be to have a protected dimension, because it's a density of an action which should be dimensionless. And for this we get a truncated four-point function which will prove positivity for an open set of the parameters, or for the closure of an open set, that is a set which has positive measure. And we check that no model with normal products of free fields reproduces all these parameters. So at the level of four-point function, we seem to have a model, but of course we know well that this is not enough, that we have to have positivity theorem involving all higher functions, and this could be approached by understanding better the algebra generated by the fields given their four and perhaps six-point functions. And of course, this is there is a complicated work still to be done ahead. And there are things I didn't have time to talk about at all, that even this attractive for mathematicians modular properties and elliptic correlation functions property reappear when we consider thermal finite temperature correlation functions of globally conformal invariant fields or energy mean values. Thank you.